You're listening to My White Belt, the best jiu-jitsu podcast in the world. Enjoy.
Welcome back to another episode of the My White Belt Show. I'm your host, Jim Trick, and our guest today is Poison drummer and fourth degree black belt, Professor Ricky Rocket. In 1986, my best friend Dave McCormick got kicked out of Bible camp. He got caught hooking up with his girlfriend. They had cigarettes. He got kicked out of Bible camp. He came home. He called me. He said, "Hey, I'm home." I said, "What happened?" He said, "Never mind. Come over." And I went over to his house, and he said, "So here's what happened at camp, but listen to this." He had a copy of Look What the Cat Dragged In by Poison, that record, that iconic heavy metal album. And we were blown away. And today, my guest is Ricky Rocket, the drummer for Poison, who is a fourth degree black belt in jiu-jitsu. Now, if those two things aren't enough to make you excited about this episode, I will add to it that for me, this was one of the most enjoyable conversations that I've had on the show, but also one of the best conversations that I've had with anybody in a long time. Just feeling like this guy, like I love him, like instant friends. Ricky epitomizes this idea that we all appreciate about in jiu-jitsu. We really care about jiu-jitsu, and we really care about wanting to be a good training partner. We don't really care about the color of your skin, your political persuasion, whatever religious beliefs you may or may not have. We really are united on the mat. And in fact, there used to be a thing called the United Colors of Benetton, and Ricky is going to mention that. It was a commercial where all of their ads sort of celebrated, you know, it would be like every person from every culture wearing the United Colors of Benetton. So Ricky epitomizes this idea that, yeah, Ricky Rocket is a rock star. That's his job. What do you do? I'm a rock star. He's the drummer for the band Poison. They're still touring. They're still alive, first of all. Second of all, they're still touring. They can still play. They're not phoning it in. They're not lip syncing. He has to be careful training if it's going to be during a season where they're going to be touring, because he can't get hurt, because people don't want to, because Poison fans want to see the original four. So anyhow, our conversation today is with Ricky Rocket, and I feel like if you can, there was I'm fascinated by high achievers, right? And so here's a guy who, how many of us own guitars? How many of us have owned drums and basses and were in bands and did this thing? Well, Ricky Rocket plays the drums, but he went as far with it as you can go. Like he's not only a professional drummer, but he's like a professional drummer in the most iconic one of the most iconic heavy metal bands ever. We all train jiu-jitsu, right? We all train jiu-jitsu. We're not belt chasing. You and I know we're not belt chasing, but we like getting belts, unless you're like, you know, full blown, I don't know, whatever. I'm sure there are some of you out there who really don't care about belts. But he also now continues to train. He just got his fourth degree on his black belt this past January, and he's still training all the time, still humble about it, still fascinated by it, still getting on the mat and doing his best. There's so much here, but at the heart of it is a guy who really It would be easy to just think about the band and their persona and what they and like what they were like in the 80s and 90s and kind of that whole thing that they don't need nothing but a good time, you know. But what you'll swiftly find is that Ricky Rocket is a very, very deep pool. And I'm just kind of going on and on. Just wanted to make the point that I am grateful. I'm grateful that he came on the show. I gained a lot from the conversation, and a lot of what I gained is sort of like just asking the question, how does an overachiever find, how does an overachiever get it done? Fourth degree black belt, rock star, cancer survivor, devoted father, animal rights activist, just this really beautiful human being who I now, after this conversation, definitely consider him a friend, and talking about maybe doing some stuff together if we could get him out here to the East Coast. But really enjoyed it. I hope you enjoy it. I could keep talking about the conversation for a while, but I will spare you any further waxing poetic about how great the conversation was. And I will just invite you now to enjoy this conversation with fourth degree black belt, rock star, certified rock star, and all around good human being, Ricky Rocket. Professor Ricky Rocket, welcome to the My White Belt Show. Thank you so much for doing this.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate it. And I know you've been after me for a hot minute, and I'm sorry it's taken me so long. I get asked to do a lot of podcasts, and a lot of them I turn down just for because people just want me to reflect on like the Sunset Strip days, or, you know, yeah, how much drugs did I do, or how many girls or whatever. And it's like, it just gets a little old after a while. So when you get a chance to talk about a passion, because, you know, most of the time they don't want to hear about the music. They just want to hear about the other stuff. Right. So,
yeah, I have no interest in, I literally have no interest in any of that. You were in one of the most, if not the most iconic metal band of the 1980s. Anybody can read anything into that experience, and they're probably right, and they're probably only scratching the tip of the iceberg. So,
but listen, you'll get a chance to catch us next year because we're going out on tour 2025. So, that'll be fun.
Let's work backwards a little bit then, because you're in your early 60s, I believe now.
I am. I'm 62.
And you just got your fourth degree on your black belt this past year, I believe.
Right.
So for you to go out on tour, or for you to train jiu-jitsu now as a man in his 60s, what does that require from you?
Well, do you mean on tour or just at home?
I kind of mean keeping yourself in a position. How long is a poison set? What do you guys do, like an hour and 20?
Something like that. Usually 90 minutes, in that ballpark.
So taking care of your body, either for jiu-jitsu or for drumming, which both are incredibly athletic endeavors.
You know what? They're both 50% mental and 50% physical. And that's probably the allure for me to jiu-jitsu, quite honestly. There's definitely a mental component. There's no question about it. I think any kind of combat has that, really. But, you know, like, for instance, like last Friday, I went to class. Dave Mamet was there, who's the famous playwright. He's one of our black belts. He's in his early 70s, or 70, I think. And a really tough dude. I mean, and a headhunter. He likes going for headlocks and stuff. But anyway, he was doing some self-defense stuff with Coach. And of course I got to be the dummy for it, you know? And then one of our other guys walked in, I haven't seen for a while. And the coach is just like, hey, go train, you know, go roll with him. And I roll with him. And then another class started. And then I wound up doing that class and doing the warm up and doing the back takes and doing it. And I mean, I came home and took a nap. And, you know, I mean, it's, yeah, it's like, I didn't want to see the mat for a couple of days. I mean, it's just, you know, it definitely kicks my butt more now. Now, part of it is what I went through with the cancer stuff, probably. You know, there's certain things I can't take. So many of the guys that train these days are on TRT therapy. I can't do that. My doctor will never let me do that.
Right.
Unless I was super low or something like that. But like to just do it recreationally to like give my edge to jiu-jitsu or whatever, they're not going to let me do that. And it would be suicidal for me, you know?
How old were you in you started in 1998. Is that when you started training?
Something like that.
How old would you have been?
I was like 35, maybe 30, something like that. Right in that ballpark.
I knew that your bio lists all these funny things that you did for work, like you were a hairdresser and a suit salesman and all these things. But
yeah.
As a kid, were you athletic? Did you play sports? Did you ever take karate lessons? Any of that kind of stuff?
I did. So my dad and I took Ishinru karate. The school closed down about a year later. So that was it for me for martial arts. I wrestled in school, intramural wrestling. I played baseball, but that was it. You know, drums became the main thing, really. I was good at wrestling, really good, actually. I definitely had a thing for it. So I didn't really do any martial arts again until I became a lifeguard. I had one summer where I was making some money, and I took Kung Fu. I'm like, let me try Pai Lum Kung Fu. There's a school close by. So I tried that. And, you know, throughout all this, I kept getting frustrated because I felt like, where is the part where I could really kick somebody's butt? Like,
yeah.
I'm not finding that.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah. Kicking and punching the air, doing katas, doing forms and all these things. But
yes. And then I see people fight and it doesn't look like what we're practicing. It reduces to something else, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then I started to look at what Bruce Lee had done and look at those movies. And I think I just put everything on the, you know, on the back burner in terms of martial arts after that.
Did it seem fake to you? Did it just seem impractical upon examination?
Maybe. I was just like, at what point do I get good enough where this is actually a thing, where it actually works, where I feel like I could walk into a situation and it would really work, you know, because I felt like I wasn't getting to that place, you know. So anyway, I didn't really train anything again until, you know, until Poison actually made money, we're on the road, and we were headlining. And that's when Brett and I hired Mark DeCoscos to come out and work with us. And we were doing kickboxing stuff.
Does Brett train?
He has off and on. He did, but not jiu-jitsu. He did, I think, Krav Maga, some kickboxing a little bit. But nothing, you know, not to the extent I did. So Mark came out with us and then he got a movie role. And then he became the Crow. You know, in that TV series.
Yeah.
But it sent me off on this idea that when I come off the road, I really want to focus on something. So I decided I wanted to do the JKD stuff, Bruce Lee stuff.
Yeah.
And so I found Cass Magda, who lived with Danny Anasano for a number of years.
And so for you, because of your pedigree as a musician, you probably have like a lot of contacts and you have access to people, right? Did that help at all, or did you just walk in to these academies and just say, oh, I'm going to train with Danny Sonato now?
No, I didn't train with Danny, but I trained with Cass, who was his right-hand man forever. But Cass had gone out on the road with Ozzy Osbourne and trained Jakey Lee.
Oh, wow.
So I had that. So at least he understood rock life and all that stuff. And he said, yeah, you know, you should do privates for a while until you get good enough. You can protect yourself and you're not going to break your hands or do something stupid that's going to sideline you from the road, you know? Yeah. And so I trained with Cass for a long time, but he introduced me to so many things. And one of those things was C-Lot. And it was the ground version of C-Lot. And I was like, it reconnected me with wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
And then one day I was at a seminar and I met John Jock and John Machado.
Yeah, come on.
And they invited me into their school. And I said, well, I'm doing stand-up. And no, just come over. And so I said, okay, you know what? I'm going to do it. I wrestled. I'll be fine. So I went over to the school, and one of the first people I meet is Eddie Bravo. He had been there about a year, and he said, oh, yeah, let me take you around. This is what this is about, and blah, blah, blah. You're going to love it. So we wound up rolling. I wound up rolling with a guy named David Meyer, who's a high-level black belt at this point, and just destroyed me over and over and over and over again. And I said, I'm going to do one of two things. I'm either never going to step foot in here again,
yeah,
or I'm going to come every day. And the next day I walked in, John Jock's wife was in there, and I said, how much for a year? I really need this. And man, I just got pummeled every single solitary day.
The guy who's my coach now, he's a second degree black belt, but probably 8 or 9 years before I started training, he invited me to a trial class, and I was real chubby at the time. And he was a guy that I knew from town. He said, you're going to really like this. You did all those karate lessons. You're going to really love jujitsu. And I went in, and I just, for an hour and a half, like you said, I got my ass handed to me. And when I was done, I said, if I'm ever going to do a martial art again, it's going to be this. So you after one jiu-jitsu class and getting pummeled, you asked, how much does this cost for a year? You were like ready to dive into it. What is it for you about jiu-jitsu that right out of the gate you found it so compelling?
Well, the thing is, I didn't go until the next day. I went in the next day. I went home with my tail between my legs.
Got it. Yeah. All right.
And literally just I don't even think I slept right that night. I'm like, for a couple of years now, I've been engulfed in martial arts, and everything I ever thought isn't true.
Yeah. Voice was right.
Hoyce Gracie was right. I'm sitting there thinking, you know, it isn't rigged. It is what it is, right? And that's what made me decide. I'm like, I was at a point in my life where I was like just trying to come out of like the poison cocoon. You know, I had been in the poison cocoon for so long. What I mean by that is there's like this shell of protection when you're in a band. The management, everybody wants to keep you in a place where you're going to be productive. You're going to play music. You're going to perform. You're going to do interviews. You're going to do everything you need to do because you're a moneymaker.
Yeah.
And as long as you're churning money, they're going to keep you going. And I couldn't take it anymore. I'm like, I it's not pampered, by the way. It's not like that. It's more like, I will facilitate whatever you need in order to get you from point A to point B to do your job, because your job makes me money. You see what I mean? Like, it's
you start
like
to
that.
Feel like a mule, like a lonely mule. I have some industry friends and a couple of friends that are in some well-known.
Well, I found when I went into jiu-jitsu, I found that nobody gave a shit who
right.
I was.
Yeah.
They may have cared for a minute, but the minute it's like we got on the mat, it's like, they're not going to like go, oh, I'm going to give him the edge. No, they wanted to take me out worse, I think.
Yeah. It almost seems like really in terms of, so in your case, it's a level of celebrity, but across the board, political persuasion, sexual orientation, race, gender, there's like a whole host of things that divide some people in life off the mat, but in the academy, at least in my academy, everyone is welcome and nothing matters besides that you're
Dude,
there.
It's the united colors of Benetton at you know, my school. I mean, literally, it doesn't matter. And all walks of life. And because of that, you learn so many things.
Mm-hmm.
Like you just sit there and you'll be, shooting the shit with somebody and going like, wow, I didn't know that. I didn't know that, you know? And hopefully people have learned things from me too along the way. But I know that, you know, I mean, I was, you know, overseas touring, or I don't remember exactly when it was, but it occurred to me that this one guy had a jiu-jitsu shirt on. He could barely speak English. I think it was Turkish or something.
Yeah.
And we're talking for a minute and I'm talking about jiu-jitsu and he's talking about it. We're laughing and we're smiling. We're patting each other in the back. And then we went through some cave or something, I think it was. And then he comes out the other side and we're waving. I just realized, man, we're like forget the Freemasons. Like this is, you know, this is literally the brotherhood, you know, of the world. You know,
our secret handshake happens to be a cross collar choke, but you know,
Exactly.
Ricky, what kind of white belt were you? If you can remember, it was so long ago.
You know, I was just eager. I think I was a good white belt. I think I was very, you know, for all the way up to brown belt, I trained all the time. When I got my black belt, it's right around the time I had my first child. Mm. And that changed a lot of things. I mean, you just literally don't have time to put as much time in.
No,
you know
what I mean? Not if you're doing it right.
And I still went, I still trained, all that stuff. But I feel like and I had actually competed, you know, when my son was, I don't know, two or three. So I don't remember how old he was. So, you know, I kept going, I kept doing it. I don't know. You know, that's an interesting question. What kind of white belt was
Did you complain a lot? Did you sit out if you got injured? Did you?
Hell no.
None of that.
No. I mean, in matter of fact, Professor Dave Dunn, who just got his fifth degree under John Jock Machado a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about this. Today, there's a lot of people, I feel like, if they start, I mean, we got ringworm and stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, there was always an infection I broke my nose. I broke my toe. I got infections. I got all kinds of crazy stuff. And we just kept going. We'd wrap it up and go do it. And it was just because I felt like jiu-jitsu was going to end. Like I felt like all of a sudden the Brazilians were going to say, we're done with this. We're moving back.
Wow.
And then we don't have it anymore. I was like, oh, boy, I got to get everything I can get right now. I mean, it was this crazy idea I had in my head, I think. But I just felt like it was going to change. And because even at that time, the UFC was in its infancy. And they were trying to, like, make it where a jiu-jitsu place had to be a jiu-jitsu club. Because of liability and anything where you're grabbing or doing a choke or something like that. Could be liable and stick fighting came under fire for a minute there. And all that stuff. And I think that lent some of my concern. I remember. And I remember those guys saying, look, we'll make this a club. And then you just have to join the club and then you're allowed to do it. And so a lot of people started to make that name, you know, jiu-jitsu club. And that's where that came from for a period of time there.
Did you see yourself as good at jiu-jitsu when you were coming up in the early days? Like, did you imagine as a white belt that you would one day be getting your fourth degree on your black belt?
No, I did not. It just seemed so far away. You know, I think by the time I was a high level blue belt, I felt pretty confident. And then when I got my purple belt, I was a purple belt for 7 years. I thought I was going to die. I'm looking at my purple belt right now, and I'm sitting there, that thing is held together by thread. Yeah. I just, because, so I trained at the Machado brothers, and then, Renato Magno, one of the guys that came over, he was, I did a lot, trained with him a lot. He was one of the lead, teachers over there. He left and started his own school and asked me if I'd come.
Is that
and
street I sports? Did.
Yes. And that's street sports. And at that point, it was almost like we started again. Like it was almost like I got, went from a 2 year purple belt right back to year one.
Really?
I feel like, yeah.
He didn't take your belt away. It just, no. The technique felt like that. Have you heard about Grapple Guard body wash? If you can't spot the smelly person at your academy, there's a chance that you might be the smelly person at your academy. But even if you're not the smelly person at your academy, you've got to do your work to prevent skin diseases. And Grapple Guard body wash is especially formulated for people who like to roll on the ground, either in their gym jams or in funny, sweaty spandex outfits. So, want to be a great training partner? Keep yourself clean. Want to be a generous training partner? Buy a bottle of Grapple Guard body wash for your friend. Be a secret admirer to the stinky person at your academy and buy them some Grapple Guard. Go to grappleguardsoap.com. This is the body wash that I use. I will never promote anything that I don't use and believe in. Grapple Guard is our new sponsor. They are the official body wash of my white belt. It's a small company. A guy named Jeff sent me a bunch of Grapple Guard to see if I liked it. I love it. It's great. Use the discount code TRICK10 at grappleguardsoap.com. Save money and support my white belt and keep your gym protected from people catching the creeping crud. Come on, filthy white belts. We can do better. We got to clean up. It's got tea tree oil. It's got all kinds of stuff that does good stuff. People will roll with you. And after they tap, they will whisper, "Wow, you smell nice." And then you'll be able to say, "It's because of Grapple Guard."
I just got the sense that he wanted to build some really good guys and not just start promoting guys that John Jock had promoted, you know?
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
maybe. But it was just a tough climb to get from purple belt to brown belt. Just felt like forever, you know? Yeah. But I feel like I was really good at that point in time. I was training a lot, you know, at least 6 times a week.
Yeah,
I do maybe a private and then a regular class and then another regular class. And then, you know, I mean, and I was always rolling. I was in a pretty good shape at that point in time. I felt good then.
I think all of this begs a question for me. You know, I'm sitting here in a room full of guitars. I've played professionally on some level since I was eight, from like 18 until my early 30s, I toured in the Christian market as a singer, songwriter, speaker guy, and sort of had a little bit of a breakup with that subculture. And then for the last few years have done other stuff more in like the alt folk market. But, you know, I've made some albums and I've toured a bit, and you know, probably my ambitions around that changed from becoming a star to just wanting to do music for music's sake. And now, you know, 6 years into my jiu-jitsu journey. So again, not to like put you on the spot, but you've accomplished a bunch of things that are pretty unique in that you have stuck with you. Well, first of all, and I don't know how you feel about the term, but to me, you're a rock star. you know, and and
that does sound funny.
Well, but like a uniquely important one to me. My friend got kicked out of Bible camp for smoking cigarettes and getting caught having sex with his girlfriend, and he came home and he said none of that matters because we're going to listen to this right now. And he had Look What the Cat Dragged In. And that record for us was like, this is a whole, he's like, first of all, we don't call them concerts anymore. They're shows. And this is Poison, right? So Poison becomes a really important band for us. So you're a person who, and I get this, I'm going to stop being a 7-year-old and it's going to get to a question in a second. But so you did this thing in an industry that so many of us would love to do well in, and 99.9% of the people living don't have any idea what it takes or what it's like. And you've now stuck with jiu-jitsu for the better part of 30 years, and you've achieved the rank of 4th-degree black belt in Brazilian jiu-jitsu under people that it's really hard to earn a black belt from. So I want to know, and again, I don't mean to put you on the spot, and I don't think you're going to have all the answers for everybody, but what do you think it is about you? What attributes have you cultivated to get to where you've been? And if somebody listening to this is looking to make the most of their path and their pursuit, what are some tips, tricks, places to start, disciplines?
You know, for one thing, I'm a little obsessive. I think I have a little ADHD maybe. So I get hyper-focused on stuff. That's a big part of it, I think. I think I come from a really good work ethic. I'm from central Pennsylvania. It's very blue collar. At 15, it was like, get a job. I'm like, I'm 15. It's like, yeah, get a job. I started working at Hardee's, you know, flipping burgers. And then I became a lifeguard, you know, eventually an EMT. And then I was sweeping floors at a salon, and I thought, wow, this is cool. Beautiful women coming in the air condition all day. I think maybe I have a knack for this.
I have a knack for beautiful women and air conditioning. If that had been a college major, you'd have a PhD.
So I did that. I mean, I've just really gone after it, after certain things, you know. But music was always the main thing. You know what I mean? It was always, everything else had to be behind that.
Did it come easily for you to become a great drummer? What did that look like? Was that a walk in the park? You're a natural and you didn't have to work that hard?
Oh, I don't think I'm a great drummer. I think I'm a good drummer. I think that I play for the song really well. I think that I have a good sense of, you know, CeCe DeVille paid me the biggest compliment of anybody, I think, ever. One day he said, what was that?
You're a great drummer. I don't want to hear any of that crap.
Oh, is that your girl? Can we say hi?
Yeah.
What's her name?
TC. She's hi, getting TC. Ready to take a shower.
Oh, that's such a sweet, that's a sweet moment. My girl would do the same thing. Cause I'll say, that's a sweet moment. That's good stuff.
Anyway, CeCe, one time I said, What do you think I should play on this? Because I don't remember what song we were writing. He said, whatever you pick is going to be great because you have such an amazing pop sensibility for a drummer.
Wow.
And I thought that was really cool. He really just trusted me to come up with the right part instead of, you know, being a typical guitar player saying, no, you should play that. You know, you should, that's what you should be doing. It's like, it was so, you know, at one point, I feel like in Poison, I got to the first record. I didn't get to do a lot of what I wanted to do. I hated the production of records back in that period of time for drummers. Yeah. It was, you know, they'd have these big AMS units, you know, with the It sounded like you were in an echo chamber with these big fat drums, but it was just, you know, it didn't have feel like they wanted you to sound almost like a machine. Yeah. You know, the fills were really you know,
if were I there did triggers anything, on the heads or was it?
No, I never did that in the studio. I tried it live just because I was with Pearl Drums and I couldn't get the drums to sound right. Sorry, Pearl. And they make great drums, but
they'll be fine.
The kits I had, I couldn't get them to work. But so we were trying triggers and I just couldn't deal with it, you know, yeah. The false triggering and all that stuff. And
so you got, did you feel like as you guys gained credibility and popularity, did future producers let you do your thing the way you wanted to do it?
Yes. Bruce Fairburn was on the Flesh and Blood record. I feel like he was really, he allowed us to do a lot more, but at the same time, he wanted to hear what it was going to be way before we ever went in the studio. He didn't want any surprises when we went in. He wanted it rehearsed note for note and just get an inspired performance. Yeah. That's what he wanted in the studio, inspired performance. He's like, it's like a photo. If a girl's beautiful, all you're doing is capturing the moment. To, you know, same idea here. Make a beautiful song, a great song, groovy, fun, rocking, whatever it is. We need to capture the moment. And so from that standpoint, he was great. The first producer that made me feel like I could play any way I wanted was Richie Zito, where I could do ghost notes and all those things. I have quite a bit of swing the way I play. Yeah. And you'd never know it in the first two records. I mean, it was just the way the production was back then. Like I said, it was very linear. They wanted it right to the click. They wanted everything just, I mean, it's just how things were produced right then, you know? So
to draw a parallel with jiu-jitsu, particularly your early days, in 2024, we have new people coming in and they have something that you didn't have. They have YouTube. And the number of guys that are, you know, being taught fundamentals, but then they're trying to supplement their fundamentals with YouTube. For you, in your early days of jiu-jitsu, let's say white to blue belt, how much of that were you happy just doing what coach was teaching? And did you have that same desire that I'm not really getting to do with my jiu-jitsu what I want to do?
Yeah, I did. You're absolutely right. I did feel that way. I felt like I always was like, are they giving us everything here?
Yeah.
Like, is there holding back a little bit, you know? And then I'd see certain guys that just could pull certain things off better. They'd get a triangle like way easier for whatever reason. And I'm like, what are you doing? Are you setting it up better? Or are you, you know, because I'm doing it and you're getting out, but you're doing it to me and I'm not getting out. So why? Yeah. What's going on here? I feel like that was transformative for me a lot at that point in time. And, you know, I didn't bounce around. You know, you couldn't bounce around to a bunch of schools. You can't be a creonch or whatever. You know what I mean?
Right.
You know, but there was a lot of different guys that there were so many people that were coming in to train all the time, and Australians. And we would host all these guys from Brazil when there would be a tournament, they'd come in and they had a whole different fresh perspective on stuff. I just feel like the Machado brothers and street sports have always been so open to ideas. And I feel really, really lucky. I mean, if, you know, Rico Ciparelli comes in that day, you know, who's a wrestling coach, who's Randy Couture's coach at Team Raw. And now I just turn the floor over to him. We're doing wrestling today.
Yeah.
You know, and now it's always said, if somebody's starts really putting the screws to you with jiu-jitsu, turn on the wrestling. And if somebody starts to really wrestle you, turn on the jiu-jitsu. Like, you know, that's the way to counterbalance that. So we would get a lot from, you know, most of our takedowns are from Rico Ciparelli. Most of our boxing is from Boom Boom Mancini, that kind of stuff. You know, Hanat's also a black belt in judo. So a lot of our sweeps and a lot of takedowns come from judo. Just feel super fortunate.
How would you describe your game at this point? What do you love? What do you love and what are you still working on?
Oh, man. Sweeps. Yeah. I think I suck at sweeps. And I'm not
You're
great.
You're a fourth degree black belt, Ricky. You don't suck at sweeps, but relative to me, you're great. But keep going.
You know, and also I think I feel like mount. I get mount and I just want to go to side control because I don't love mount. And, you know, if I was an MMA guy, it's all about mount, right?
No.
So I'm okay in mount, I feel like. So I need to work those two things. But, you know, I think the main thing I'm working around most of the time anymore are injuries.
I was
2 years ago, I was training with Coach and I'm just like, stop, we need to stop for a second. Something feels weird with my leg.
Yeah.
And I got up and my whole right leg had gone numb. We had been doing like suplex kind of throws that day. And I think that might have tweaked it.
Yeah.
Next thing I know, I'm getting MRIs and everything like that. And I have some stenosis. I have some, you know, ruptured discs, you know, it could be from a million things, off-roading, riding dirt bikes, jiu-jitsu, playing drums for years. I mean, just life, right?
Right.
So it could be lots of things. And just one thing, you know, is the straw that breaks the camel's back, kind of, right? So I still deal with back stuff. I don't want to get surgery. Maybe one day I'm going to have to face it and just do it. But right now I'm doing everything else. So I work around injuries, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the worst things is, you know, I know you wanted to talk about the cancer stuff a little bit.
But I do,
From having head and neck cancer, you know, when you get radiation to the neck, it just destroys your salivary gland.
Yeah.
So I have to drink all it. So the first 20 minutes, I think, every time I go to train, I'm just so thirsty. I can't get enough water.
One of my closest friends went through it last year.
Oh, okay.
He actually had to have part of his tongue removed. They rebuilt it. They rebuilt it from his leg and the battery of radiation. I don't know if you had this when you went through your radiation, but did they create like a grill that covered your head and sort of held you in position?
Yep. Yeah.
So for Gary, that was my friend and business partner in my day job. The radiation, when I found out that you went through that, I was actually really eager to talk about that with you. The radiation for him was really awful. And I think when people hear radiation, they think, oh, they must have just, you know, put him in a chair and zapped him with some radiation. But it's not like that. Hey, My White Belt is brought to you in part by Origin. And if you're looking for a new gi, go to originmain.com and use the discount code TRICK10. Listen, Origin gis, in my opinion, are the best gis you can get anywhere in the world. And I've worn everything. And I know that there are like the brands where you go and you like spend a ton of money on a gi, and it's no different than any of the other gis that are made in Pakistan or China, but they have a funny little logo on it, so you think you're getting something great. When you buy a gi from Origin, you're actually getting a gi that is made by hand in the great state of Maine by people who love their job, are treated well, and it shows in the quality. So, gis, jeans, hoodie, I mean, you name it, they make it. But then they also produce the line of Jocko Fuel, which most of you listening have probably tried Go Drinks or Mulk or one of their other incredible products created by Jocko Willink. So go to originmain.com, use the discount code TRICK10, you'll save money, you'll get incredible gear, and you will support My White Belt.
No. And for the first couple of weeks, I was like, this isn't so bad, you know, and then little by little starts wearing you down, wearing you down. All of a sudden you're waking up and you can't swallow. And yeah, it was miserable. The thing that really sucked was at the end of all the radiation, they can't do a test to know if the cancer's gone. They have to wait for 3 months, let everything calm down.
No.
And then they do the imaging to look and see if between the chemo and the radiation, if they got everything. When they did that to me, it hadn't gone. So now what's left? Surgery.
Yeah.
More chemo, which just strings you along. Mm-hmm. And then there was this thing called immunotherapy, which nobody was doing at the hospital I was at. So I wound up finding a doctor, Dr. Cohen, Dr. Ezra Cohen, down in San Diego. And I went down and visited him. And he said, I think we can do this. I have three different trials right now. We've had some good luck. And let's give it a shot. You know, I don't think you should just run and do the surgery right now. And I said, okay, let's do it. And I had to go through a battery of tests for a week. I stayed down there for a week. And then we started it. And they every 9 weeks, they would do a PET CT MRI scan. Yeah. Every 9 weeks, do all this blood work every time you went in. I'd have to go and get every 3 weeks, get infusion, take two pills a day. You know, that was a regimen. It wasn't that part of it wasn't that bad, just to get the infusion every 3 weeks and to take two pills a day. I mean, you know, and that's not forever. It's just, you know, until you can get rid of it.
Right.
In 9 weeks, it was 95% gone.
No kidding.
It was incredible.
That's an incredible miracle.
Yeah. Then after 18 weeks, and probably before that, but again, they don't do the test except every 9 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
But when we did that second set of imaging,
yeah,
it was gone. There was nothing there.
Thank God.
Nothing there. I mean, it was near miraculous, really.
Do you have any kind of a personal faith, without like trying to cross a line in terms of your really private life? But are you like a prayer guy? Do you believe in any of that stuff?
Yes. You know, it's.
And if you don't want to talk about it, we can, you know, don't.
No. It's okay. I love this conversation, quite frankly.
Thanks, brother.
Because.
Me too.
There is a part of me that is a super believer. And a part of me that just thinks the way that we think about all this stuff is very flawed.
Okay? 100%.
So I've had three occasions in my life where I really needed prayer to do something for me.
Mm-hmm.
And those three times it has worked. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the last time. Okay. Where, I mean, doesn't mean I haven't prayed, you know, for things, sure. But I mean, really huge things in my life. Like, for example, when I'm sitting in a jail cell and I'm being accused of rape and I'm going, I've never raped anybody. I know I haven't. And I'm just praying to God, you got to let the world know that I didn't do this. Like, yeah. You know, and I didn't know if it was some girl that was mad at me, or I didn't know who it was or what it was. And then when I found out where it had taken place, supposedly, I was like, I was never there in my life. So I'm like, somebody is impersonating me or something. And I prayed to God, and bam, turns out that's exactly what happened. A guy was impersonating me. Wasn't his first go around with impersonating people and doing this crap to girls. He had a history of it. He actually went to jail for it before. Well, he had faked it and said he was a photographer for Whitesnake and kidnapped a girl for 3 days. But that's a whole other story.
Oh,
but that was one time. And then this last time was, I mean, when I got that news, they had this little chapel like at the hospital, and I went in and I just went, if there was ever a time I can't do this on my own.
Yeah.
I, you know, and then, you know, is that what happened? I don't know, but I don't really believe in coincidences to that degree.
I know.
So something, but you know, but in terms of regular, like biblical stuff, you know, I have a lot of different, there's a lot of problems with that because I do believe in the dinosaurs. Okay.
Sure.
And I don't believe that the earth is 3,000 years old.
Like, I mean, all, you know, reasonable people that are telling the truth. Right.
Right. Yes.
It's like, let science do science's job and let faith and scripture do faith and scripture's job. And, you know, I try not to go too far with this because I know I have, you know, all kinds of listeners, and I'm definitely not here to convince anybody, but it just is a curious. I'm always curious to hear about the spiritual practices of people who aren't necessarily conventionally religious. My friend puts it this way. He says, religious people are afraid of going to hell and spiritual people have already been there.
Huh, that's a really cool saying.
It's a good quote, and it has kind of and then the other thing that I just heard recently that Bono said, Stephen Colbert asked Bono what he thinks happens after we die, and Bono said he thinks that's when we're born. He said he thinks that all of this is labor pains, that everything we're experiencing here is labor pains.
Maybe.
There's a couple ideas throwing those.
You know, out. There's a really great program on YouTube, and the guy's a brilliant PhD, and he goes around the world seeking answers to these very deep questions.
Is it Jordan Peterson?
It is not.
Oh, okay.
Keep going. It's called Closer to Truth.
Ooh.
Closer to Truth.
Oh, I haven't heard of this.
And you'll go down the rabbit hole and you will not escape, I promise you.
I love it.
He talks about everything from and goes to the most brilliant minds in the world and gets their opinion, okay?
Yeah.
The most brilliant physicists, biologists, chemists, I mean, just all these incredible people, doctors, all these people, philosophers, and gets their perspective on, like, is there really parallel universes? Is there, you know, is that even possible? Is there quantum physics that, you know, just if there's God, then why is there this? And you know, is God responsible for evil too? And, you know,
I mean,
just
those,
all these very
questions.
Deep questions, you know?
Yeah.
You know, all I know is that when somebody needs me for the cancer stuff,
mm-hmm.
I don't like it, okay, because it triggers me, okay?
I'm sorry. Yeah.
And I have another part of this too, but it's very triggering because I have to relive it again. Oh, yeah. My friend's gone through the no problem with what you were talking
yeah
about.
I get it,
but I mean, when I walk through this with somebody, and I've mentored several people through it, you know, and a couple people, I just had a friend, one guy that I did everything. He got on an immunotherapy trial, everything, and he just passed away. It just didn't work.
Yeah.
Nothing worked for him. It was just for whatever reason. You know, they're still trying to figure this stuff out. We've gotten so much better at it, but it's very triggering. But at the same time, I have to answer the call. It's almost like if there is a God, he made a deal with me and said, okay, you need to, I'm going to do this for you. You need to help.
You're
going to
do this for them. Yeah.
And
yeah.
And it's tough. I have to relive it a lot of times. But there isn't a day go by that I don't think about it. I'm constantly reminded every time I eat, it's still hard to swallow. I'll never be able to swallow easily. You know,
when I was in high school, my parents gave me a Bible, and my dad wrote in the front page of the Bible, it said a passage that said, blessed be the God of all comfort who comforts us so that we can comfort others when they are afflicted. And it sounds like that's the domino effect
yeah.
in
yes.
your life. Do you?
It's a pay it forward kind of thing. Yeah.
you didn't want it in the first place, but hey, if I'm going to make it through, I'll help somebody else make it through. I don't want to take too much more of your time, Ricky. You've been incredibly generous. So I just have a couple more things. But the first one is, because jiu-jitsu, at least in my own life, inherently cultivates resilience, what is the relationship between your training in jiu-jitsu and your ability to face cancer? Is there any connection?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But I'm a hypochondriac, and I have been for
most of
my life. Yeah, absolutely.
Like afraid of getting cancer? You were afraid of getting cancer back then?
Yes. Anything would come along, you know, because I honestly love life. I don't want to die.
You get a great life, man.
There's too many neat things to do. I mean, really. I've definitely had my nights. Don't get me wrong, but I never got super wrapped up in the whole drug culture thing. I remember CeCe telling me, we have a lot of conversations, and he was like, I'm so jealous of you that while I was sleeping till 4 p.m, you're running around Europe, like seeing the Sistine Chapel and doing this and that.
Yeah.
You know, because I'd get up in the morning and go see everything I could. So I wasn't really getting messed up. I had been through it. I tried a lot of that stuff as a teenager. Now, don't get me wrong. I've had my nights. I've had my share. Brett and I were best buds all through those years. Right. And Brett's a diabetic. So, you know, he has a stop there, no matter whether he wants it or not. Mm-hmm. Okay. So he would get to a place where he had to stop. And so that I would stop, you know what I mean? And you know, we'd both go back to the hotel or whatever it was, you know, we have to keep a check on each other like that. And I think it kept us from getting, I think if he wasn't diabetic, I think we would have both been completely out of control and I probably wouldn't be here.
Yeah. Thank God for diabetes for him. Right.
Well, this is the thing, man. Sometimes, you know, I remember, and I'll just be very blatant and honest, back in the day when we all lived in this one bedroom apartment in Hollywood, there was this girl that I was with, and I got the clap from her. Okay. I'm just be honest, everybody. Yep.
If you were in poison and you hadn't gotten the clap at some point in time, I would be very disappointed.
Well, and the thing is it kept coming back because it was just a tough strain and, you know, and all that stuff. And somebody's like, you know, I remember having a conversation with somebody about it, you know, on the down low. And I'm like, honest to God, I'm happy I got it. I'm like, why? I'm like, because I'm always going to wear a condom now. And I could have got something way worse.
Way worse.
I could have got AIDS. I could have got, you know, who knows, Hep C, whatever, you know, and, you know, so that was, you know, sometimes these adversities, you know, teach you lessons or keep you from making more mistakes if you're smart enough to see it. You know what I mean? So when you say thank God for diabetes, you know, I don't think Brett's happy that he's a diabetic, but at the same time, where would his life be? He's helped a bunch of other people.
Yeah.
That's one thing I'll never take away from him is he's done these diabetic camps and, you know, really reached out to made differences in a lot of people's lives. I'm trying to do the same thing with the cancer stuff.
Yeah.
You know, when somebody's, I had a really cool thing. Well, I won't get into that because it's too long of a story, it was just somebody else that I had helped out. And then consequently, I didn't know who they were and they helped me out in a big way. So hey, you never know.
Brett can still sing. And he looks, in getting ready for this, one of the things that I love to do is I will look at like Johnny Cash. And I will listen to Johnny Cash, or I'll watch a video of Johnny Cash playing a song in the late 60s, the late 70s, the late 80s. And I'll watch him do the same song over multiple generations just to see the evolution of the performance. But Brett can still sing. And I watched some tour video of you guys last year, and he looks like legitimately happy out there.
Yeah.
Like he doesn't look tired or beat up at all. Like he's, you know, like it's going... Your band is aging pretty friggin' well, I think, right?
I think so. I don't know if we all got lucky or what, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, 62. I don't think I look 62.
No, you look great and you're still training and it's why it's like, I feel like for me, you know, I was, you know, morbidly obese. And if you had told me 20 years ago that I was going to be doing jujitsu, I'd be like, you got to be kidding me. I'm going to be like, still, I wore a size 66 inch pair of pants, you know,
wow.
No matter wow. how many geese John Milan from Origin sent me, they weren't going to fit my fat ass. But now they,
I love that dude, by the way. He is
I love
the
him.
Best.
Well, it's so funny because we were having a conversation. I was like, yeah, Ricky Rocket said he's going to come on the podcast. And he goes, oh, I love that guy. And I go, wait, you know him? And so he's just like, he's been, so here's one other thing I'll say about the jiu-jitsu community. Where else, what other activity can, so you mentioned Hoist earlier. Have you trained with Hoist?
I did. I did a seminar with Hoist.
Hoist just came out here.
A seminar as a student with John Jock this Saturday.
Dude, John Jock.
It's an open thing. So Dave invited me and I'm like, of course. Anytime I can train with that guy. Are you kidding me?
Jean Jock started sharing my posts on Instagram and I almost fell off my chair. And then.
Wow.
And then we started going back and forth. There's a high possibility.
He's one of the most important grapplers of this century.
He's so, what that guy can do with a hand and a half is mind-boggling. And anybody, like, you know him. I don't know him, but anybody that I've ever talked to that knows him literally loves him.
Oh, he's got a great personality, a great way of teaching. Carlos is all the brothers are great.
Carlos
Hagen's,
came on the
Hagen
show.
Hagen is a kick is in the. I love Hagen. I mean, they're just a great family. I had never, the only Machado brother I had never trained with was Carlos, and I got the opportunity to do that when I was in Texas, and so that was really, really fun. But there's some guys that I would die to train with. I mean, that I just, you know, some of the newer school guys, I would love to. I'd love to train with Gordon Ryan and Tonin and, I mean, the B team jiu-jitsu guys.
Yeah.
I mean, these guys, there's Cade. I mean, this kid, Cade Rotello. I think I'm saying it right. God, I mean, this kid is just coming up with stuff. I mean, he's redefining the rear naked choke.
Do you train no gi?
I love training no gi. I'm like 50%.
And do you train legs? Do you have like a leg game?
I do. Yeah, I do. One of my best buds, John Salami, he owned a 10th Planet.
Is his name really gym. Salami?
Johnny Salami.
Come on.
Yeah.
that guy's not real.
I was with him today. I was at an event and he came and took pictures. He does photography and cinematography. But yeah, he's a black belt, legit black belt. He was a 10th Planet guy. So I get a little bit of that game. I don't love, the only thing I don't like, and this is just, I don't like wrist locks. And the reason I don't is because I'm a drummer. That's the only reason.
Yeah, be real careful.
You got to be careful. I mean, I always
tell
you,
you must have some kind of contractual agreement, right? If you guys are going on tour, because if you know nothing, you just have to be responsible and be careful.
I don't want to be replaced. You know what I mean? Now, it's a problem because promoters want the original poison, and that's what we are.
Yeah.
So if somebody came out in my place, it would not look good. So nobody wants that. They don't want that for Bobby Dahl. They don't want it for CeCe, you know, they don't want it for Brett. But
You two just did it. Their Sphere shows, Larry Mullen Jr. wasn't playing with them.
I know, and
that's
I
so
love that
weird,
dude,
isn't it?
That's it's weird because he's amazing. It's funny. I was just out at Yamaha Drums today. So I'm a Yamaha endorsee. So
one of my good friends. Go ahead.
Larry's been with them for 40 years, something like that. He's been with them forever.
My friend was their VIP liaison for 7 years. So he was on the road. He was on the road with them, and they threw his wedding and stuff. And he's got all these cool U2 stories, but none of them train jiu-jitsu. So they're all dead to me. None of them matter. Ricky Rocket, yeah, thank you so much for this. And yeah, you know, I don't know what I could ever do for you, but the fact that you responded to my invitation and that you've been so generous on this call, this just epitomizes to me what our community is like. And as we just bring this conversation that I thoroughly enjoyed in for a landing, I always like to have the person that I'm talking to speak to the person who's laying on the couch that really wants to try a jiu-jitsu class, but they're not for one reason or another. What's your message to that person?
You know, let me close this whole thing by this old Bruce Lee statement that if the more you think about it, the more it makes sense. He said at one point in time, and I think a student had asked him that he just wanted the spirituality part of martial arts. And Bruce Lee said, in order to find your true spiritual self, you must first step through the physical door. So through that adversity, you kind of learn things about yourself because we're interconnected. People want to say, oh, that person's intelligent, they don't need this. Or that person's a physical guy and he doesn't need the, you know. It's connected. We're physically connected to our minds. Our minds are connected physically to, you can't separate the two. Yes, it can balance different ways, you know, but sometimes I go back to that little Bruce Lee thing and go, yeah, whatever's going on to me today, that physical uncomfort is, you know, I mean, this is the essence of military training. You know what I mean? You know, I didn't serve, but God, I wish I would have. That's one thing I wish I would have been able to fit into my life somewhere along the line. And I think I would have been okay at it, quite frankly. But like, you know, some of these guys that I think a lot of military guys do super well at jiu-jitsu because they've already faced a lot of adversity. Mm-hmm. And you know, you're stepping through that physical door every day. And you're not thinking about why are you thinking about your problems when somebody's trying to like bent on your destruction right then? You really can't.
You can't. It's a singular focus.
And there's something just life-changing about that, as basic as it sounds, you know.
Beautiful. Ricky Rocket, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jim. I appreciate it.
And that was a conversation with Rockstar and Fourth Degree Black Belt and really beautiful human Ricky Rocket. And I'm glad you tuned in today. I hope you enjoyed that episode. I loved that conversation. And as I said in the intro, I feel like I made a friend during that conversation. And I'm eternally grateful for your presence here, because if you're not here listening to the My White Belt Show, there's no My White Belt Show. So thank you. No other requests, but just continual gratitude that you're tuning in, that you're listening, and it means the world to me. This is My White Belt. I'm your host, Jim Trick. Until next week, train hard and train smart.